Hi, this is Tom Needham for the Long Island Music and Entertainment Hall of Fame podcast, featuring interviews with people who have been inducted into the Long Island Music and Entertainment Hall of Fame. Some of these interviews were previously aired on the Sounds of Film radio show. I hope you enjoy the next episode.
Hi, this is Tom Needham, and you are listening to the Sounds of Film, and I am so excited to have on the phone with us right now a true legend, Jimmy Webb. He's a songwriter, composer, singer. He's known for his hits, Up, Up and Away, The Worst That Could Happen, MacArthur Park, among many others. In 1986, he was the youngest person ever inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame, and he has a brand new book called The Cake and the Rain. It's out on St. Martin's Press. And Jimmy, thank you so much for joining us today on The Sounds of Film.
Tom, it's my pleasure, and I appreciate you having me on.
Well, it's my pleasure because you've created so much great music through the years, and I'm looking forward to talking to you about your life. One of the things that was interesting to me is I'm involved a little bit with the Long Island Music Hall of Fame, and a number of years back, we inducted Connie Stevens, and she was great. I love her, and I really kind of got a kick out of like the first chapter in your book. You open up with a story about heading out to Las Vegas and working with Connie Stevens. Why did you decide to open up your book with this story?
It was my first sort of public performance, and it was my first go at singing, and that was a great little stage at the such a historic place, Wilbur Clark's Desert Inn, and that stage, everyone had played there, including Noel Coward. The guy I bought my house from, Phil Harris, he had played there with the Crosby Brothers, like almost 10 years to the day that that I opened there with Connie. So, but she was a mentor. She was very generous. She gave me completely equal building, billing out on the strip on this big sign. And, It's almost a strange thing to say, but Vegas had a quaintness to it in those days. It was like, like the neon. There was a neon sign over the main entrance at the DI, and it was a giant saguaro cactus. It was all lit up and everything. And I can't help thinking what that sign would go for today.
Yeah.
If it was on the market, because it was, there was something cool about the smallness of Vegas and the fact that the ninth floor of the hotel was blanked out because Howard Hughes was living there.
Wow.
And I took my Corvette up there, and oh, I was having a ball, man, you know. I didn't know that I was going to get, you know, criticism for playing Vegas, but you know, it was a very polarized time, and I think having read the book, you'll realize that I sort of found myself midstream there. I identified strongly with my peers and with the Monterey Pop Festival and with the kind of changing tides, you know.
Yeah.
Social change and political change. On the other hand, my music was anchored in middle of the road artists like Glenn Campbell, Mr. Sinatra, Barbara Streisand recorded my stuff, and the Fifth Dimension as well, which is a group that I produced with Bones Howe.
Right.
So, that was just my first foray into the, you know, sort of the public life after I got my first three or four hits. And I had a lot of publicity. I was, you know, a famous guy for being, for writing songs, which was really unusual at that time.
Well, you bring up a couple of things that I wanted to talk to you about. Let's go on a little bit longer about what you kind of just touched on, which is that on one hand, you had this reputation now for writing great songs, but with figures like Sinatra and the Fifth Dimension and so forth. But in your own personal life, you were more interested in social and political issues. Was this something that you struggled with in terms of your image? And you do get into it in the book a little bit. And I found that really
after I played the DI with Connie, again, there was nothing but love and affection in that relationship, a lot of respect, because she worked very hard. She went out on stage, she tap danced, and she sang, and she did comedy, and she did costume changes. I mean, she worked, you know, her buns off for like an hour and a half. So I would book no criticism of her. For playing, I mean, it's silly for playing Vegas.
Yeah.
And by the when I got good reviews there, and by the time we had finished our engagement, I had another offer from Caesar's Palace to play 8 weeks a year, two 4 week engagements a year. And all I was required to do was play MacArthur Park. When the piano would come up on a hydraulic lift,
wow.
I would play MacArthur Park. And I said, you know, and I'll sing it too. And they say, no, we won't pay as much for that. but they just wanted me to play the piano, probably wear a fancy outfit. I mean, we never really got that deeply into it because... they offered me a phenomenal amount of money. I hesitate to even tell you, but I don't know what it would be in today's money, but they offered me $40,000 a week.
Right. Wow.
And I thought about it. I had a meeting with David Geffen. We talked about my career. David said to me, don't play Vegas. Don't play Vegas. You know, if you want to join that small group of singer-songwriters, you know, the Joni Mitchells, the James Taylors of this world, you can't play Vegas. That was the nexus, you know, of my dilemma, really, is I was being tempted with a great deal of money.
Right.
And deep down inside, I wanted to cast off and do something completely artistic. And at one point, I remember going through this self-examination and saying, do I want to be an artist or do I want to be, you know, a middle-aged songwriter, you know, who's never... You know, who's never even tried to do anything, has never tried to make a record, and at that point, you know, being 21 years old, it was a pretty easy decision for me to make.
Well, you have the unique distinction of being like one of the few people, maybe the only other like person I can think of is like a Burt Bacharach, where people do know who you are publicly. You really did have a presence. You were on television. You've toured. And yet you're mostly known for being a songwriter, although you've put out many, many albums, of which we're going to be featuring some of your music tonight on The Sounds of Film.
Well, I appreciate that.
Yeah, I mean, great stuff. But I was wondering, like, what is the key to your success in terms of maybe you never got to be, you know, a Joni Mitchell in terms of that part of your career, but yet you did become a very well-known person, personality, and a songwriter, you know, that people knew it for your songwriting. And there's not too many people that can do that. What was the key for you?
My decision was right. My decision to record and record and record and record. I mean, I never stopped, and I still haven't stopped. My last two records actually charted. You know, it was the Geezer chart, but it was like they were like on the chart.
Right.
But I made the right decision when at that particular moment in time when I turned down the big money and really didn't go the Vegas route, because I think I can't imagine what alternate universe that would have been, but I think it would have been something like a young Liberace-type character playing a lot of flourishes and runs and arpeggiating all over the place. And I can't help thinking that it would have been short-lived, that it wouldn't have lasted very long.
Yeah.
And as it was, I've been able to, not to put too fine a point on it, but I gained the respect
right.
of the rock community. You know, I had a hit with Artie Garfunkel.
Right.
I went on to work with Linda Ronstadt, and I just widened my musical palette to the point where it was really kind of hard to criticize me. Because I had worked with so many people and I had the respect of so many people across the board. And you might ask, well, was that your plan? Well, it was in a way, because my plan was not to be pigeonholed, not to be typecast out of the business as so many people really were.
Yeah.
By one or two records, and then you're in that groove where you're sort of expected to do that all the time, or for as long as you can, or for as long as the public will show up and buy it, or show up at your concerts, and then you're sort of like stuck with reinventing yourself. And I guess I just wanted to leave the door open to be anything that I wanted to be.
It's smart.
That's a really hard thing to do in life.
Yeah.
And I've been partially successful at, that. I mean, you and I here, we're on the electric radio here, and we're talking about my music, and that was 50 years ago.
Right.
which is a very, very difficult thing to get my head around.
Yeah.
Frankly, because I don't feel old. I still play. I'm going down to Nashville this weekend, and I'm sold out at the City Winery, and I've got a new album in my head that's running around and saying, I want to be made. And I'll be meeting with my producer down there and trying to figure out, well, where are we going to make this album and how are we going to make it? And, I just won't ever quit. That's one of my salient points. I just, will not give an inch. And that I kind of got from my farming forebears in the Midwest,
Well, I wanted to ask you about that a little bit. One of the things that's really unique about this book, you're not just a great songwriter, you're a great writer, and you decided to write this book in a very creative way. You jump back and forth in time between moments in your music career, and then also a lot of really interesting stories about your family. And I was wondering, from writing this book, have you really gained some insight into how your family, your religion, your work ethic has influenced your life?
Well, I think so. I think that anyone would. I think that anyone could benefit probably from just sitting down and sort of attempting to write a dispassionate version of their life. One of the things that I was, exquisitely careful about was not to paint myself in a heroic light unless it was absolutely necessary. and that's a sort of joke.
Yeah.
I thought about that a lot, and I didn't want it to become a pain to self-aggrandizement and look what I did and look how important I was. I think that, to the contrary, I wasn't very important. poor surroundings. The unlikelihood of me making a name for myself in this world was the odds were astronomically against it. And somehow or other, I ended up locking onto this songwriting thing when I was 13 years old, and I got it buried, you know, in my soul, and I could not get rid of it. So, it was that, you know, it was that kind of single-mindedness and really just plain stubbornness. It's the same stubbornness that gets you through the process of writing a book.
Right.
You know, as you stand back and you look at your life from this point of view, from 70, it looks a lot different than it looks from 20.
Right.
You can see a lot more detail, and you can see where you screwed up.
Yeah.
See where you might have done a couple of things right, but on balance, I don't believe people when they say, if I had my life to live over again, I would live it exactly the way I wouldn't change a thing.
Right.
I think that's very suspect. I think that's wishful thinking at best, and at worst, it's someone who's sort of lying.
Yeah.
Because I, for one, would love to go back and change at least half of my life, and maybe more, because I think that I was right about 50% of the time. So I think that it's, you know, it does give you, well, it was Socrates who said that the unexamined life is not worth living.
And, yeah, yeah.
You know, the corollary of that is the unlived life is not worth examining. Now, I didn't say that. Actually, someone else said that. But I think there's a lot of truth in that as well. And I look at my life and I say, well, I lived it. You know, there were times when it was a hell of a mess. But
you did accomplish a lot. And
I was always pushing at it, trying to make it work, trying to make it make some sense for me. And so most of it I can live with. Some of it I do regret.
Well, we don't have so much time, and there's so many parts I want to get to. One part of your life that I wasn't as familiar with that was sort of a revelation was I didn't know that you had spent some time out in Hollywood and that you had an office on a Hollywood lot. And can you tell us a little bit about that period?
Well, I was... you know, I was a hot new property in town, and I signed a contract with Universal to, you know, do some. Actually, it was amorphous. It was like they didn't really know what they wanted me to do until I got out there. But I did have a bungalow on the lot, and I could get on the lot anytime I wanted. And I had like four or five parking places, which were like gold.
Wow.
I could look out the window of my bungalow and see my Corvette or see my Cobra. I knew Abraham Polansky. He was a good friend of mine, and he would come by. And, you know, eventually, I mean, now I wish, you know, I had taken more advantage of the opportunity I had. But the big thing I was trying to do there was a musical version of Peter Pan.
Right.
And Mel Ferrer was producing. Herb Ross was going to, who was a very hot property. Herb Ross was going to choreograph. And Mia Farrow was going to play Peter Pan. And that for a season, I was caught up in the Hollywood thing about, you know, trying to put all the pieces together of a major motion picture, all the moving parts and all the challenges of something like that that involves so much effort over over a long period of time. I just wasn't suited for it. I was never, and I never have been, I'm not particularly proud of it, but I'm not particularly a team player. I don't do well in committee.
Mm.
And
so that's one of the lessons you learned along the way.
Yeah. And it just became a very complex thing. I remember, I mentioned it in the book, I remember Mia Farrow, whom she and I were friends. I mean, close friends, nothing more than friends.
Yeah.
Perhaps unfortunately for me. But I remember her calling me one day and saying, you know, I've been thinking about Peter Pan, and I think you should be played by a boy. You know, it just presents you, you know, the film business presents you with these conundrums, you know.
Right.
And, you know, you're talking to your friends, someone that you really kind of love, and they're telling you something that you really don't want to hear. And yet, you know, I don't convince her to do something that she's going to regret.
Right.
So it was one of those things. And finally I thought, you know, maybe it would be better for both Universal and for me if I just went back to playing my gigs, making records. And
well,
I've always had a kind of crush on the film business. I still think that I will be involved in a film before I'm finished, in a major way. I just have a feeling about it. I have a couple of ideas I'd still like to try out.
Are you interested in scoring or more?
I scored a lot of pictures. Well, I'm not a lot. I mean, there's guys out there have scored hundreds of movies. I mean, I scored like maybe 7 or 8 films, and never really liked the films that I scored very much. And with one exception, Frank Perry's revised history of Wyatt Earp. It was called Doc.
Oh yeah. Okay.
And that was a real movie with real actors, Stacy Keach, Faye Dunaway.
Right.
And Frank Perry was a great producer who just sort of gave me my head as a composer. I thought it turned out well. There wasn't a lot of music in it. And so I never really got that. I did a picture for Hugh Hefner. I don't know whether I even wrote about that or not, but I did a picture starring Victoria Principal and Johnny Crawford called The Naked Ape, based on a book by Desmond Morris. You know, I had my flirtation with this, you know?
Right.
And I was a wild kid. You know, it was hard for me to get into the discipline of working in the studio like that for someone else and really, really executing on command. It's kind of, you know, it's embarrassing in a way because I wasn't a very good employee.
Well, I'm afraid that I've used up all our time, but Jimmy, I really hope that we can speak again because you have so many different aspects of your career and you've done so much great music through the years. You know, I'm sure people have asked you about this, but Bruce Springsteen recently said that he wants to record some new types of music, and he actually specifically mentioned you by name. He said he wants to write songs like Jimmy Webb.
Well, that's extremely flattering. And
what does that mean, though? Songs like Jimmy Webb.
Well, I'm not sure. I live and die by melody, chord structure, and narrative. And, you know, I think that Bruce, you know, has the narrative thing down. He's not really known for using arrangements. Maybe he means that he would like to try some strings on something. Maybe, you know, I don't know how to look into his mind, except I just have to bow graciously and say, thank you, boss, you know, for such a great compliment, you know.
But in your opinion, what is a Jimmy Webb song? I know you've written many different types, but what do people mean when they're saying Jimmy Webb-like music?
Well, it's melodic. It has an interesting chord structure. We'll put that in the maybe yes, maybe no category, but that's what we try for, is an engaging chord structure, which is something that's strictly out of fashion right now. And then I would say a beginning, a middle, and an end. Mm. My songs tend to be little tiny movies. They have characters, and the characters are on a mission of some sort a lot of the time. And especially in my early songs, they were mostly blue collar guys from small towns. You know, they weren't Gershwin guys who had tuxedos and lived in New York.
Right.
And they weren't necessarily L.A. guys either, even though I've written a lot of albums about the L.A. culture since those days.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I really admire about you is, like you said before, you never stop. You just keep on doing it. And there's so many artists that don't do that. They just rely on their old hits, and you're always coming up with new material. And some of your less known stuff, I think, is some of your best stuff.
Thank you so much. Listen, yeah. I'd be happy to talk to you anytime, okay?
Well, thank you, Jimmy. And I want to recommend to our listeners.
Just again, you just let me know.
Okay. The book that we've been talking about is The Cake in the Rain. It's out on St. Martin's Press. And if you've enjoyed some of the stories that Jimmy's been telling us, I highly recommend that you check out his book and all his new recordings. And we'll be playing a lot of his music tonight. Jimmy, thank you once again.
Thanks for the bump. I really appreciate it, pal.
No problem. And have a great night, and talk to you
soon.
Bye-bye.
Okay.